This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In Chicago's Great Fire of 1871, about 300 people perished. But on that same October date, another fire raged in northeastern Wisconsin and in the southern tip of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. The Great Peshtigo Fire claimed the lives of at least 1,200 people. The fire burned huge areas of timber along both sides of the Green Bay waterway. Peshtigo, Wisconsin, was destroyed. 60% of its population died in the fire. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we remember that fire and reflect on the work of the men and women who fight wildfires. Our guest is writer and firefighter Peter Leszek. His latest book is Ghosts of the Fireground, Echoes of the Great Peshtigo Fire and the Calling of a Wildland Firefighter. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call in the Champaign-Urbana area. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Peter Leszek has been a firefighter in wildland and municipal settings for more than 20 years. He's the author of 9 books, including Letters from Side Lake and The Bear Guardian. He's also written for many magazines. His new book, Ghosts of the Fireground, is published by Harper San Francisco. Again, our telephone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Peter Leszek, good afternoon. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Celeste. Happy to be here.
This fire was the deadliest forest fire in North American history, but many of us have never heard of it.
Exactly. And unless you actually grew up in Wisconsin and you were exposed to it in the state history classes that you probably took in grade school, it is largely unknown. And that the chief reason being that it started essentially at the same time, at the same day, and virtually the same hour as the Great Chicago Fire, which, of course, has been very prominent in the American consciousness. As a result, Peshtigo, even at the time, was sort of overshadowed by that other event, and it simply added to the additional horror of the incident because aid was relatively late in getting to those people.
Mm. Can you give us some idea of the range and power of this fire?
It really was sort of a terribly magnificent event. Roughly 1.2 million acres burned in a matter of hours from a late afternoon into the next morning. And if such an event were to happen today, it would be planet-wide news. It would be just huge. It created a firestorm that is a fire that essentially consumes everything. It's like a blast furnace. It's sucking oxygen in from all directions. And I believe there was nothing, we saw nothing like it in the world until perhaps the fire bombing of Dresden in World War II, or perhaps even the atomic bomb drops on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's the kind of energy we're talking about here. And what was amazing to me is that I focused on the account of one survivor, a Catholic priest named Peter Pernan, who really fascinated me for all sorts of reasons. But to see what he saw and live is truly extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, you note in the book that some people who survived the fire were driven mad.
Yeah, I absolutely went insane. This was a report from the Wisconsin authorities afterwards, and actually, it was believed at the time, a physician from Green Bay, actually, who came up in the weeks following the conflagration, it was his theory that everyone who had survived would be dead within 10 years of various maladies. Now, that turned out not to be true, but that was the belief at the time. Also, Father Pernan and the survivors who ended up in the river, he and others were actually blind the next morning, and I've speculated in the books that it may have been radiant heat burns to the eyes, somewhat like looking at someone while they're welding, for instance, can give you these infrared burns. Or perhaps another one was just the psychological inopia. They had seen enough and they didn't want to see anymore for a while. And the priest was actually totally blind for the space of a couple of days.
Yeah. Reflecting on his experience in this fire, you began to think a lot about what courage is and what it requires.
The thing I took away from the priest's account, among others, was that here was an individual who I doubt had any stress management training in that time. He certainly had no training or experience for these kinds of conditions. And I like to at least partially give credit to his to his mindset. He, in the midst of that blaze, one of the most important things to him was to preserve the appliances of his ministry, that is the tabernacle, the chalice, the paten, the tools of the priesthood, if you will. And he was focused on that, and he later admitted that he knew that these were merely physical objects, that they could certainly be replaced. But for him, they were really invested with huge symbolism because of his faith. And he really, at all costs, wanted to preserve these items. And so he was focused on these rather than primarily on his personal survival. And it seems sort of paradoxical, but someone who is focused beyond their own survival, I think many times has a better chance of ensuring that survival. And so against these incredible odds, he makes it to the river, stumbling over bodies, fighting through a mass of panicked humanity, pulling his cart because his horse refused to budge. His horse was so terror-stricken that he simply couldn't harness the horse to the buggy. And he, out of mercy, he turned the horse loose. Later, the horse comes up to him just trembling with fear. The horse is burned to death that night. He finds a very poignant moment in his account. He finds the remains of his horse the next day and is really, or 2 or 3 days later, is really grief-stricken. So anyway, here's this guy struggling through this just extremely punishing, terrible environment, heat and smoke, and he can barely see. And people are panicked around him. People are literally dropping dead and bursting into flame. And he makes it to the river with his tabernacle and his chalice and such. And then in a moment that I found just so powerful, he comes to the river. And there are many people lined up along the banks. In his account, it's not clear how many. And they are simply waiting to die, and because it is obviously the judgment day. This is what they're thinking. Mm-hmm. This is the wrath of God. This is the apocalypse. It's the end of the world. And here is the priest, who you would think would be the first subscriber to that notion, and he's not having anything of it. And he just physically drags people into the river. And this one moment, it's a catalyst. From the account, it seems pretty clear these people simply would have died on the riverbank, except for this priest. And he drags two people into the river, and one guy actually jumps back out saying, "I'm wet," you know, of all things. And but then he hears a series of splashes, and it was that one action of his that drove the other people to get into the river, and where some of them survived.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Peter Leszek, our guest this afternoon. His latest book, Ghosts of the Fireground, Echoes of the Great Peshtigo Fire and the Calling of a Wildland Firefighter. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. A listener is waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. A very interesting program. The History Channel did a documentary on the Peshtigo Fire and the Great Fire of Chicago, and they seem to suggest that the cause of the Peshtigo Fire was possibly some kind of meteorite. Would you comment on that?
That was a very common theory, and it turns out not to be true so far as I can tell. There's a little bit of background here. First of all, it was an incredibly dry summer. As I recall, there were like only two rainfalls the entire summer. So first of all, it was very dry. Second of all, there were fires burning all summer long. In those days, things were fairly well unregulated. There was a new rail line going into the UP from Wisconsin to bring back copper and iron ore. So they were clearing the right-of-way and burning the residue. Farmers were taking advantage of this dry season to get into some wetter ground, normally wetter ground, and they were practicing basically slash-and-burn agriculture. So fires were burning all over the place all summer long, and something that would not happen today necessarily. Well, then along you have this extremely warm and dry October. You know, the temperature that day all across Wisconsin was in the 80s, you know, which is not typical at all for the first week in October. And here came this huge cyclonic low that was centered over Nebraska with the very warm and high and shifting winds. And all of these things came together. And there was this, all of these small fires essentially merged into this huge conflagration. I think where the meteor story may have come from, that when you have a fire of this magnitude, it creates all sorts of phenomenon. And it creates its own weather. It creates its own environment. People talked about, a lot of people thought there was an earthquake happening because the ground just shook with the energy release that was going on. And this is a phenomenon that modern firefighters have commented on who have been very close to large fires or entrapped by them, that the ground seems to shake. I was at Yellowstone in 1988 when the North Fork fire made a 40,000-acre run in one afternoon, and the smoke column went up tens of thousands of feet, created its own lightning. It just created its own little world. And I think the meteor story came out of some of this phenomenon. Now, it's certainly true that if you had a meteor sufficient to make it to the surface, sufficiently big, and it was hot under tinder-dry conditions, there are reports of them starting fires. But if that indeed happened, it would have been just one more fire among dozens that were burning, and it really wouldn't have made any difference. It was the, it was this confluence of the extreme weather conditions and the extremely dry fuels and the massive amount of fuel due to this wholesale logging operation that was going on at the time. And it all came together and just coalesced into this firestorm.
Does the caller have any other question? I think the caller has left us. Other calls are welcome. Questions, comments, 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. The Peshtigo fire was caused in part by burning to clear land.
Yes.
So we've got an issue here of land management. What role does land management play in fire prevention, and how are we doing today?
Well, it's a huge, complex scenario. And, you know, the fuel loads at Peshtigo, we speak in terms of fuel load tons per acre in the fire business. And, you know, a kind of logging was going on at the time that, at least in this country, no longer happens. Entire townships, you know, were logged off. There is a report of an individual in Port Huron, Michigan, who has sort of an experiment, tried to see how far he could walk without his feet touching the ground, walking from log to log, slash pile to slash pile, and he went for over a mile. And we no longer generate the fuel loads like that over that extensive an area. You know, it's always been amazing to me that, you know, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, northern Wisconsin, and northeastern Minnesota were essentially clear-cut in about 75 years, and they were using handsaws and horses. It's an amazing feat. So you had intensive, what we would now consider mismanagement, you know, of the resource. And this was definitely a huge contribution, you know, to what happened. Obviously, a fire has to have fuel to continue, and there was the mother load of fuel in northeastern Wisconsin and other places in the upper Midwest that year and for years following. The sad irony is that little was learned from as great a disaster as Peshtigo was. Nothing was essentially learned because the huge fires and these land practices went on well into the 20th century, and the final episodes were the Hinckley Fire in Minnesota and the Cloquet Fire in Minnesota. I believe the Cloquet Fire was in 1918. The Hinckley Fire in 1894, they both killed hundreds of people, burned vast acreages of ground, and it was the same scenario as Peshtigo. So, you know, nothing was learned for generations, actually, is one of the sad results of this.
Mm. Prescribed burns, are they a good strategy? They release that energy that's being piled up. But
well, fire in the wild land mm-hmm. is mostly a good thing. biologically speaking. It's an agent of decomposition. Things have to decompose. We have to recycle the nutrients, or life comes to a stop. And fire is one of the quickest, most efficient agents of that decomposition. So it's absolutely endemic and essential to the biosphere. And we live on a fire planet. This fire is formed and reformed, by fire, among other things. Unfortunately, in this country, after there was a huge catastrophic series of fires in the American West in 1910, chiefly in Idaho and Montana, it's become known as the Big Blow-Up. And many people died. Small communities out there were burned to the ground. Hundreds of thousands, I mean, actually millions of acres, went up in smoke. And after that, the United States government essentially declared war on wildfire. Fire was in the wildlands was deemed to be evil, and we would suppress it at all costs, and including human life, the lives of firefighters. And unfortunately, quite frankly, it was very successful. It was way too successful. And then along came the World War II, where the Japanese were actually trying to set the American West on fire. They were launching incendiary devices over the American West with balloons, trying to ignite the forests as an act of war. And as a result, we ultimately ended up with Smokey Bear. And Smokey, whatever his other merits, and I've been in the Smokey suit. I have played the god Smokey. And I'll tell you what, it is the closest thing to being a deity as you can get. Everyone is in awe of Smokey Bear. It's been one of the most successful propaganda campaigns of all time. And because the government has never allowed Smokey to be commercialized, I think even the little kids understand that he's pure. You know, he's not Santa Claus. He's not the Tooth Fairy. Smokey is something special. And so we convinced generations of Americans that fire in the wild was just, unremittingly bad, and nothing could be further from the truth. We need fire in the wild landscape, and, we've come to realize that, especially since the 1950s or so. Unfortunately, every once in a while, you get a prescribed burn that gets out of control, Los Alamos being the most recent example. It was a disaster. Hundreds of homes were lost in Los Alamos. Quite fortunately, no one was killed by that fire. But then people look at that and say, "Oh man, the government lit that fire. We're from the government. We're here to help. We're going to burn your house down." But the thing to remember is that the vast majority of prescribed burns you never hear about, the thousands and thousands that are done every year, because they are done successfully. And of course, mistakes enter into any human endeavor. But since we have so successfully eradicated wildfire from the landscape, it's simply now our job to reintroduce it.
Mm. Being in the position of fighting fires and now that we put this into some perspective, fire prevention includes fire, in a sense, in order to have just the right mixture.
Well, one of the ways, if you have a huge buildup of dangerous fuels in the forest, there's more than one way to handle it. But one way to handle it is burn it. That's one of the quickest ways to dispose of that fuel, to recycle the nutrients. We're preventing fire or fighting fire with fire. It's an old concept, but it can be a very effective way to manage. It's not the only way, but it is one of the tools.
What are some of the other tools?
Well, if you had mechanically to go out there and remove brush to thin stands of trees that create fire breaks around certain areas, are some of the ways that it's handled. And, of course, in the last few years, there's been a huge debate going on across the country, but particularly in the American West, about the management and or mismanagement of the national forests and other public lands. On the one hand, you will have people that say, well, there's not enough logging, and that's the problem. Other people will build the case, there's been too much logging, and that's the problem. There has been too much fire suppression, that's the problem. We haven't done enough prescribed burns, that's the problem. It boils down to two things. One, it's a very complex problem, as anything involving an ecosystem is. And second of all, we place our own values on these things. The fire that I consider to be a rejuvenating kind of blaze, if it's taken your house out in the process, you're not going to have the same view. And so it comes down to what's our conception of a forest. I may have one view, you may have another. Is the forest there simply to provide us with wood fiber, or is the forest there primarily there for biodiversity, or is it something in between? And these issues become very complex, and unfortunately there's no silver bullet. There is no one solution for every landscape. You know, there's a multiple number of solutions, in fact, for any given landscape, depending on what we wish to manage for. And since there are so many of us on the planet, it is impossible for us not to manage. You know, we can set aside a wilderness area, for instance, and of course the first question that's asked is, what is a wilderness? Is it the way the land was in 1750, or is it the way we would like to see the land, our modern conception of a wilderness? And so I think that the bottom line is, when we come to manage our forest lands and our range lands and all the rest of it, we have to decide what we want to do. We have to decide what our goals are, and we have to decide how important other species are to us, and decide what place fire has in that whole mix.
Why the term in the subtitle of your book, Wildland Firefighter? Why the term wildland? Why not forest fire?
Well, because, you know, many, you know, all sorts of vegetation burns out there. There are not only forest fires, there are grass fires, there are chaparral fires, rangeland fires. And so wildland is just the all-encompassing generic term for any fire that is burning, you know, in an outdoor landscape. And as a wildland firefighter, I've worked in all of those fuel types. You know, I've been in Florida and Georgia and Colorado and Canada and Montana and Minnesota and Michigan, you know, all over the place. And every one of those areas has a little bit different fire regime. It has a different ecosystem. There are different things that burn. There are other things that don't burn. Fire behaves differently. It's frankly one of the charms of the job is that, you know, there really is no such thing as a routine fire. You know, they're all different. You know, you have a new game every time you show up, depending on where you are and what's happening and the time of year and the time of day. Mm. So wildland is simply the all-encompassing term.
It's hard for me to think about this job and think about the charms of the job.
Well, it's true that, you know, and I've you know, I'm sort of a grand old man now in this game, far older than most of the people I work with, at least out on the line. And so I'm a fire instructor now, and I have a hand in training a lot of rookies. And, you know, I try to make the point that, look, this job is 90% drudgery and tedium. And then you can also throw in the hazard if you'd like. Your chances of being injured are excellent. Your chances of being killed are less so, but the possibility is there. And you do it for the 5 or 10% of the time when it's a peak experience. You do it for the time when the excitement is there, the adventure is there, the moments that you can get no other way. We were just in Colorado. I was working, myself and my crew were in Colorado, the big fire south of Denver here a few weeks ago. And at one point, we flew with a helicopter onto a mountain peak at 11,589 feet. And as we topped that ridge, you know, the entire front range of the Rockies was displayed before us on this just wonderful crystalline day. And we sat down on that spot, and I would venture to guess that not many people in the history of the planet have ever stood on that very spot and seen that vista. And you know, and we were there for a purpose. You know, we were working this fire. It can be just a very heady feeling. And at the end of the day, at the end of the season, it's a job where you've got stories to tell. And, you know, a lot of people, when they get home from work, they don't even want to think about it, much less talk about it. And I guess it's been my little sort of conceit that whoever dies with the most stories wins.
Tell us how you became a firefighter.
Well, quite by accident, really. When I was growing up, I had no notion that I was destined to, you know, suck smoke and blow black snot, we know, which is a big part of the job. And I had no desire to be a firefighter, even though one of my uncles was a career municipal firefighter. It just never occurred to me. And then 1981, I joined our local volunteer fire department, and I didn't do it out of any motive other than community service. I was pure in that sense. I just thought it would be a good thing to do, to be a part of the community, to make a contribution, and really had no notion what I was getting into, none whatsoever. And most people who come into it really don't either, just as if you'd have no notion if you're going into investment banking. I mean, you have certain impressions that you've gained perhaps from the media or from stories you've heard. But quite frankly, if everyone who joined a fire organization knew exactly what they were getting into, they probably wouldn't join, and I think that's true of many things. But after I joined this fire department and began to respond to fires and other emergencies, I slowly began to realize I was a junkie and that I had found a vocation quite by accident, and that this was really, had a strong feeling that this is, you know, what I was meant to do.
Yeah. You write about your spiritual life in the book Ghosts of the Fireground. You were raised as a Catholic. Then, as a fundamentalist Christian, you studied to become a minister.
Yes.
And then you also say that gradually you've detoured past Christianity. And I'm wondering, how has your calling to fight fires helped you along this path?
Well, I drew, and this was one reason I was so fascinated by the Catholic priest, Father Pernin, because here was a cleric. And, of course, I had a background in Catholicism, although that's less important to the story. But here was someone I could really identify with, because I had trained very rigorously for the ministry, had intended to become a cleric, decided not to be. So I thought I had a certain affinity for this gentleman. And I realized, not for the first time, but his story brought it into, I think, sharper focus, that here was the guy who had survived this. You know, as we mentioned, he was focused on something, you know, beside himself, and he was ministering to his flock in that sense. And that's how I also view a fireground leader. I think of a fire crew as less than a work crew and more of a congregation of sorts, because you need to bring people with different temperaments and different proclivities and different experiences. You need to meld them into a unit, and not necessarily a strictly militaristic kind of unit, although it has those overtones. But you need to meld them into a very efficient, well-adjusted crew, because the stakes are very high, and these people need to work together. These people need to have a sense that they're responsible for each other. And not unlike a congregation, you know, a fellowship, a brotherhood or a sisterhood. And so the fireground leader is, in that sense, a minister. And the fireground leader has an advantage over his or her firefighters, because if you are a good crew boss or manager, your first concern is your crew. And therefore, if you get into a very dangerous situation, a situation that is generating a lot of fear and perhaps even panic, you have the advantage of thinking about someone else before you think about yourself. And, you know, my biggest fear, and I have many fears, and I guess if I'm ever not afraid of this anymore, I better quit, but it still scares me. But my biggest fear is not that I will be hurt, not that I will be killed. I mean, I don't want those things to happen, obviously. But my biggest fear is making a mistake. And a mistake that costs someone else their life. That is my greatest nightmare. And in one sense, that's a huge asset, because I can sort of lose myself. I can forget about myself. I mean, if the fire is about to overtake me, I'm going to take action. I mean, you know, it's not a suicidal thing at all. But I have a focus beyond myself of necessity, as Father Pernin did. And in that sense, it is a ministerial kind of calling.
And that being concerned about your crew, the congregation, allows you to deal with the fear and allows you to deal with the stress.
It helps a lot. you know, it doesn't eliminate it. There are other techniques that you have to use. You know, we often think of firefighters as working very hard, which they do, and there is a lot of grunt work involved. There's just simply a lot of bulwark that has to be done, whether it is a municipal firefighter or a wildland firefighter. There's simply a lot of work to be done, hot, sweaty, dirty work. But the key to success on the fire ground, the key to survival on the fire ground, is always mind work. And someone asked me here, I have the luxury, I have attained to a place where I get to select my crew for the summer. I get to hand pick them, and which is a very great privilege that some people don't have. They get whoever they're sent, and that can be either good, bad, or indifferent. But I get to pick my crew. And someone once asked me, well, what are you looking for primarily? What's your main criteria? And I said, I want them to be smart. Now, if they can bench press 400 pounds, that might come in handy. If they can run a marathon in 2.5 hours, that might come in handy. It will come in handy. But first of all, I want them smart. I don't want any dummies out there. I want people who can think. I want people who can show initiative. I want people who are there. I mean, I want them alert, you know, and that's my chief criteria.
Mm. Peter Leshek is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a firefighter. He's also a writer. His latest book is Ghosts of the Fireground, Echoes of the Great Peshtigo Fire and the Calling of a Wildland Firefighter. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this portion of the program this afternoon. Listeners, if you'd like to join the discussion, give us a telephone call. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. There were two stories this fire season that were so sad, so shocking. A man who set a fire in order to be hired as a firefighter, and then the Forest Service employee who started a fire then tried to disguise the fact.
And can I tell you another one that's just sort of the opposite?
Okay.
My wife is also works in fire. She works as an information officer on some of the bigger fires, and she was at a fire in New Mexico in May that was accidentally started by a local resident. I believe it involved a cigarette butt. And he felt so distraught and was so upset that he had started this fire and burned down some of his neighbor's houses that he committed suicide. So, you know, they're sort of the opposite side of the coin. And I've been asked a lot about the two incidents of firefighters as arsonists. And, you know, on the one hand, you know, it's in the same sad category as, say, a police officer who is also a drug dealer or an accountant who's cooking the books, for that matter. So, you know, in every profession, there are those who sort of break the public trust. You know, two of anything don't make a trend, and it was disturbing to all of us. The Hayman fire, I was on that one that was started by a Forest Service employee, so I was, you know, acutely aware of that situation. And while we were working that fire, we were in a briefing one morning where there were probably about 100 of us gathered around, and then we heard the news. It was announced that one of the Arizona fires had been ignited by an emergency firefighter who knew... whether or not that was an exact motive, who knows? You know, the motives of arsonists can be very complex. But who knew that he was relatively assured of getting on the payroll to fight this fire? And there was just a collective groan when that was announced, because obviously it reflects badly on all of us. But there is a history here. Back in the 1930s, for example, during the Great Depression, when times were obviously very hard, people in rural areas all across America understood very well that if they lit the woods on fire or the rangeland on fire or whatever, they had a very good chance of being paid to put it out. And it was actually called job hunting. In fact, if those of you who have met, those of your listeners who have met, may have read the Milagro Beanfield War novel that was very popular about 20 years ago, that was one of the vignettes in the novel. It was in New Mexico. They needed some money, so they set the woods on fire and got on the payroll. So there is a history here of that. And And quite frankly, the incentive for firefighters, seasonal firefighters especially, such as myself, there would be an incentive there. Quite frankly, the more fires I go to and the bigger they are, the more money I make because I work longer hours. But all I can say is that it is, although it's very distressing to hear of these things, it is rare. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. And especially with the Hayman fire that that's going to have some very long-term effects for the watershed, for the water supply of Denver, Colorado. If it had been a lightning strike, it would have been, these things happen, and there have been some unfortunate consequences, but that's the way it goes. But as I looked at that fire, particularly from the air, and had a really sort of eagle's eye view of the result, I was particularly poignant to realize that this one had been more or less purposely set. Mm.
Let's talk with some other listeners. Next, we're going to go to Piatone, a caller on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi. Am I on?
You are.
Yes, okay. Lightning hit a wheat field, one of my wheat fields here several years ago, and I was told the flames were reaching up into the sky, maybe 34, as high as the trees. There were some trees around it. This was a lightning strike, and this makes me think of the prairie that we had around here. Before the white man came. Are there any stories or Indian folklore about fires that would sweep the plains, the prairie?
Well, actually, absolutely. In fact, the biggest cause of fires on the prairies and the Great Plains were fires that were purposely set by the Native Americans, and they did it for many reasons. One, they understood that fire was the best rejuvenator of that landscape, and in fact, the original prairie landscape simply could not exist without fire. Without the prairies burning, you would have not had the bison. You would not have had the buffalo herds. It was a very fire dependent ecosystem, and there were certainly the lightning could ignite these fires on the Great Plains. But the Native Americans lit them up quite regularly, and right now in the areas, for instance, in my home state of Minnesota, the western half of Minnesota was prairie country. There are a lot of organizations trying to restore that original prairie land with the various grasses and flowers that grew there, and you have to burn it pretty much annually to maintain that. And fires swept those regions regularly.
Well, what happened to the buffalo? I mean, these fires, from my experience, they're fierce. This wheat field just blew into a
Well, they can
fire.
Be, and that's a question I often get asked by people. Well, what about the animals?
Yeah.
And all I can tell you is that, they have adapted, they adapted over millennia to these fires, and most of them just got out of the way. And even at Yellowstone in 88, where we had some very intense, fast-moving fires, the mortality rate among the elk and the bear and the bison and other animals that live there was very low. They get out of the way. Mm-hmm. They smell smoke, they move on. And it's true that any forest fire you have, there's a certain level of wildlife mortality. Not every creature gets out of the way, but it is really surprisingly low. The animals out there are part of that ecosystem. It's been burning since the glacier left, and they know how to deal with it.
That's neat. Also, Yellowstone seems to have come back. There was an article in the Chicago Tribune. Are you familiar?
Oh, yes. I mean, Yellowstone, again, another fire ecosystem. And when we were working the fires in Yellowstone, seeing them firsthand, there was a lot of questions going on at that time. Well, what's going to happen with all of this? And as far as I've been able to determine since the fires, the only negative impact on some of the slopes, the very steep slopes that burn very hot, and that as a result in that high, dry plateau will take some time to regenerate, there was some siltation into the trout streams, for instance. But these fires were largely regenerative. The elk began to flourish because of the fire landscape, the rejuvenation. There were more forbs and grasses for them to eat. And of course, during those days of 1988, the public had the impression that the whole thing had gone up in smoke, which is not the case at all. Most of the fire was in a mosaic pattern. It's a very common deal where you'll see, of course, some blackened sticks. Other places it was merely singed. Other areas were untouched. And this is nature's way with fire. Now, we had kept fire out of Yellowstone for a long time, and this may have been a contributing factor to some of the intensity. But on the other hand, you can find some research that indicates that about every 200 years in the Yellowstone ecosystem, this is exactly what happens. You have this huge fire that rips through the landscape, and although some things are destroyed, other things are renewed. And, you know, the main thing about our forests, any forest, is that it's hugely dynamic. It's always changing. And, you know, some trees live longer than we do, so we tend to think of them as almost like mountains. You know, they're there when you're born, and that same tree's there when you die. But forests are changing all the time, and fire is one of the main agents of that change.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon, and I want to go next to someone else who's been waiting patiently on line one in Champaign. Let's make sure we get this caller in here before we're out of time. Caller in Champaign, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is a very different sort of question, perhaps. I grew up along the Mississippi River and consequently was part of sandbagging and retaining floods for years and years and became quite critical of the land management practices and the state and federal policies that allowed people to keep going back into areas, and so you're saving the same house over a 20-year period. Maybe you have three or four floods in that area. And we've changed some of that now, but I wonder, what are some of the policies or practices that you've reflected on as a firefighter that you think could be changed? And just be curious about your opinions on that.
Well, it's a good question. It's a good topic because all over the nation, people over the past few decades have moved into the woods, or perhaps I should say moved back into the woods. During the heyday of the pioneer days and the logging days, there were some areas of the country that were more populous 100 years ago than they are today. But there's been a huge movement of people wanting to live in the mountains, people wanting to live in the woods for all of the obvious reasons. But, of course, when you live in the woods, you have to understand that you've built in fuel. Especially in the Mountain West, where there are some very volatile fuels and where the steep slopes contribute to fire spread. A lot of the fires we work out there, and as a firefighter, I've noticed the difference even over the past 20 years, that places before where we could maybe just let the fire make a run and catch it at the river or catch it at the next ridge or whatever is no longer necessarily a viable solution because we've got three or four houses in there. And suddenly the ante is raised. It's been proven that firefighters are willing to take greater risks to save a structure than to save a tree or a patch of woods, for example. So it's made it a more dangerous environment. On the other hand, there has been this realistic notion in the fire service that, look, if you have chosen to build there and you are not in that house, let's say you're not there or you've been evacuated, am I going to risk my life to save your house? And in fact, a lot of structure triage goes on, and I've seen it done from the air. I remember in Idaho several years back, we were working a fire near the Salmon River Breaks, which is very steep and flashy fuel kind of country. And there were houses there now, and we flew over in a helicopter with with our operations chief, and he basically made snap decisions from the air. This house we'll try to defend. This one's a goner. Again, human life was not involved in these decisions. The people were not there. And so it becomes a question. Now maybe we can save this house that's in the wildland if we spend $100,000, with helicopters and air tankers, the whole thing. But does it make any sense for us to spend $100,000 to save a house that's, say, worth $50,000? And, of course, any time you put these air operations assets into play, it's a risky thing. And so we're risking people's lives and the taxpayers' money to save this house. And in some cases, we make the decision not to. And that's just the way it is. And that's not to say that people can't live there. They obviously have every right to live there. But what they need to understand is that they're taking a risk. And, we may be able to save their house and we may not. And if it's too dangerous, we may not even try.
Yeah. This raises an interesting question. I want to follow up here, then we're going to have to wrap it up very quickly. But, along the Mississippi River after the flood several years back, there have been policies put in place to discourage people from rebuilding in the floodplain.
Right.
They've actually moved a whole town to higher ground. And then also along coastlines where there's severe weather, hurricane susceptibility, there's been some action taken to try to get people to try to discourage people from building there. Has any of that happened in wildland areas?
Well, you know, there is a new federal and state program out now called FireWise, where grant monies have been allocated to local municipalities to educate people who live in what's called the rural-urban interface, is the technical term, that for them to take steps. Unlike the flood, the flood and the fire thing is a little bit different. I mean, if the Mississippi goes over its banks, there's nothing going to stop it. There's nothing you can do. Your house is flooded. There's precious little you can do. I mean, you can try sandbagging or whatever, and we've seen that, if you have a major flood, just really nothing works. Whereas individual homes, without a lot of effort, can be made very fire-resistant. And so people are encouraged to put non-combustible roofs on their houses, like metal roofs. People are encouraged to have a little bit of what's called defensible space around their structure so that there's not direct flame impingement. I guess what I'm saying is you have a much better chance to protect your home from fire than you do from flood. Because when it comes to a fire, it's sort of a case-by-case basis, whereas a flood is so general and so overpowering. Now, there are some areas of the country, Southern California comes to mind, where I am amazed that people still rebuild there or that the insurance companies will even allow it. You get the Malibu fire, it races up through the chaparral, it burns down the houses. 2 months later, all the remains are washed into the bottom of the gully by the inevitable monsoon rains, and then everybody starts the whole process over again. And that does mystify me. Mm. But there is a program afoot to help at least educate people about the risks of building in the wildlands and what they can do to mitigate it. When it was farm country, it wasn't that big a deal because obviously around a farm you had these wide expanses of a field and you had this sort of a built-in buffer. But for folks just building out in the woods because they want to be in the woods, it's a different story.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to say we've strayed past our time here, so we've got to wrap up very quickly. Peter, thank you very much for talking with us
this afternoon. Well, I enjoyed it very much.
Peter Leszek has been our guest this afternoon. He's the author of Ghosts of the Fire Ground, Echoes of the Great Peshtigo Fire, and The Calling of a Wildland Firefighter.